My castaway this week is a historian. A lifelong communist, his series of books on the history of the 19th century are regarded by many as seminal works of scholarship. In his latest work, The Age of Extremes, he's turned his attention to the 20th century to equal critical acclaim. His Marxist beliefs have not made his life easy, and in the early years particularly, academic promotion came slowly. He takes a detached view of these matters. Much of my life, he admitted recently, has been devoted to a cause that has plainly failed, but there is nothing that can sharpen the historian's mind like defeat. He is Eric Hobsbawm. So you admit defeat, do you, Professor Hobsbawm, that Marxist Leninism is a dead duck?
The Soviet Union and the October Revolution, to which in my very young teenage I committed myself, has obviously been defeated and won't return again. I don't think the cause has been defeated, but at least it will not be realized, if at all, in the way in which we thought it was going to be realized.
And why was it defeated, if I can ask you a very simple question, which I'm sure has a complicated answer? But its principles, of course, you would still argue are right. Would you say that it's therefore been distorted in practice?
Yes, it was attempted, it seemed to me, in a country in which none of the conditions for trying to build a socialist society were present.
But you've spent practically all of your conscious life devoted to the principles, the dream of this communist utopia. Is your ability to intellectualize the reasons for its demise constant, or do you sometimes, have you ever reacted emotionally to it? Have you never felt, you must have done, racked with disappointment that it hasn't worked?
Of course I've been depressed. I continue to be depressed. It was a good cause, and in the last decades, it seems to me, the cause of social justice and social equality has retreated very rapidly. I can't be other than depressed under these circumstances.
Tell me about you and music. How important is it to you?
Pretty important. Initially, I think I took mostly to jazz. I think when I was very small, my parents tried to press my nose into the classics more than I was prepared for. That's Central European background. But then eventually I discovered the classics too.
So there's some of both in your selection of eight. What's the first record you want to play?
Charlie Parker's Mood. Not only because Parker is an extraordinary artist, but also because in some ways it reminds me that people must continue to learn. Like most people who started going on jazz in the 1930s, I didn't like modern jazz initially. Didn't understand it. Didn't see what it was about. And yet, because I discovered that people like Parker had their roots in something which I did understand, the blues, I got converted. And I got converted in what was, I suppose, already verging on middle age. So it shows you that you never have to stop.
Charlie Parker and Parker's Mood. Can we talk first about your origins? You were born, in fact, in the year of the Russian Revolution, 1917. Where and to what kind of parents?
A mixture. My father was British, born in London, the son of immigrants. sort of small craftsmen immigrants. The family trade was cabinet making. My mother was Austrian, more middle class, I think. And they both met in Egypt before the war, got engaged. The war broke out. They couldn't marry in either of their countries. And so they married in Switzerland and went to Egypt, and I was born there. But after the war, we decided to go back, in this case, to Vienna.
To Vienna, where you spent your early childhood. So you were British, always have been. You were a Jew, and you spoke fluent German.
Absolutely, yes.
And then, at the end of the 20s, both your parents died, within a couple of years of each other.
Within a couple of years of each other, yes. I mean, I was 12 and 14, that sort of age.
What did they die of?
My father collapsed in the street, heart attack, I suppose it must have been, in one of the very bad winters. My mother died of TB, which in those days was a killer. And we didn't have a lot of money.
And what happened to you and your sister?
We were taken over by an aunt and an uncle. It so happened my father's brother had married my mother's sister, so there was a closer relationship between these uncles and aunts, and they more or less took us over and went on educating us and looking after us.
And this was in Berlin?
This was in Berlin.
Which, of course, was a historic time, early 30s.
It was an extraordinary period, absolutely extraordinary. I mean, these few years are, in many ways, the absolute crucial period, at least in my life. It was living through what we knew to be an extraordinary, dramatic turning point in history.
You knew then, even then?
Yes. We knew what the stakes were. I remember the afternoon when Hitler came to power, you know, seeing the headline as myself and my sister were walking back from school. I was already politically organized in some kind of schoolboys association, communist type.
Can you remember your reaction in that moment when you saw that headline?
The reaction was, what, if anything, could be done? And meetings, distributing leaflets, all the rest of it, didn't do much good.
And what do you remember of those months after Hitler came to power in January 33? How did things change?
As far as I myself was concerned, obviously they didn't change. We weren't affected by it. We were English. We were not German. Consequently, the worst that could conceivably have happened is being expelled. But as far as other people are concerned, we knew that in some ways this was the end and a terrible, dangerous period had begun. Otherwise, it so happened that my family left a few months after that, not for political reasons, because my old man's job folded in the Depression and went back to England to try and reconstruct his life there.
That was the summer of 33 and you would have been 16?
Not quite 16, yes.
Let's have record number two.
Well, record number two, I suppose the moment has come to have a bit of militancy. I'm sorry to say that Johann Sebastian Bach, whom I'm going to play, never did a cantata about the International. So I'm doing the next best thing. I'm going to play something, the opening of Bach's cantata number 80, Ein feste Burg ist unser Gott, which is the great Lutheran militant hymn of the Reformers.
The opening of Bach's cantata number 80, Ein feste Burg ist unser Gott, with the Vienna Chamber Orchestra and Academic Choir. How many of your family were left behind when you came to England?
Oh, a number of them were left behind, and I suppose at least four of them disappeared during the war and in the camps. But that is the situation of every Jewish person in the West that I know.
So those were the years, you say, which determined your politics irrevocably?
Yes.
And in that sense, then, for you, being a communist has been an emotional commitment, or was an emotional commitment before it was a rational commitment.
Yes, that's the way these things happen. It's a bit like music, a bit like falling in love, but except falling in love doesn't necessarily imply a subsequent intellectual elaboration.
But you go on to find out more about it and decide whether it's true love or not, which is obviously what you did with the CP.
Well, I was told by one of my schoolmasters that I obviously didn't know what I was talking about, and he pointed me to the school library and said, read some of this stuff, like the Communist Manifesto and something, and discover what you ought to be knowing about the things that you claim to believe in. And that's what I started doing. And that's how I got interested in history, because the school history that we were taught in Central Europe was of no interest whatsoever.
So both of those things, your interest in history and your interest in communism, were determined then and then were confirmed when you came to this country and went to Cambridge?
Yes, I think so.
And your dedication was total. Would you say you would have done anything that the party told you to do?
Of course we all would. The commitment, particularly in the 1930s, we were all deeply, profoundly committed. There wasn't anything that was more important in life than the great cause.
And if you'd known the terrible things that were taking place in the Soviet Union at that time, in the name of communism, you know, terrible indiscriminate suffering and mass murder, would you still have remained loyal?
Well, in the first place, we didn't know. We didn't know the extent of it. In the second place, insofar as people told us, we didn't believe them. Didn't want to believe them, perhaps. We didn't believe them.
So you're saying that such was your commitment and your dedication that if there was a chance of bringing about this communist utopia, which was your dream, it was worth any kind of sacrifice?
Yes, I think so.
Even the sacrifice of millions of lives?
Well, that's what we felt when we fought World War II, didn't we?
Isn't there a difference between killing someone in war and killing your own?
We didn't know that. Dead is dead.
Shall we have record number three?
Record number three actually fits in with this rather gloomy note. It's by Schubert. And it comes from, I suppose, one of the great creative ages of history, the period from the 1780s to the 1840s, which I wrote my first volume of the 19th century about. And it's a bit of the Schubert Quintet with Casals. And I suppose it brings out that the world is an extraordinary place and a place of deep emotions, but not necessarily of fun.
Thank you.
part of the first movement of Schubert's string quintet in C major, played by Pablo Casals, Milton Catims, Alexander Schneider, Isaac Stern and Paul Tortelier. You were right in the middle, Eric Hobsbawm, of Red Cambridge, but your name doesn't seem to have cropped up in all the spy literature that's been written about it since. Why is that?
I was too open and militant a communist to, for anybody, even the most conspiracy-minded, ever to accuse me of having been a spy.
So you were never approached? You wouldn't have been any good to them at all?
I don't know. But at all events, I was never approached.
But did you know Burgess, Philby, Blunt?
Yeah, I knew a few of these people, I mean, in various capacities. But obviously I didn't know that they were spies. However, the point about Cambridge is that politics wasn't the only thing in Cambridge. One did an enormous amount of things. And it was a marvellous time to be there.
And
absolutely extraordinary time.
You got a double starred first at the end of it all. And then came the war. Your politics ensured that you were kept out of intelligence. You served instead with the Royal Engineers, and you found yourself in what you've described as a working-class unit, which you've said converted you to the British working class. What did you mean by that?
I didn't know much about the British working class, in spite of being a communist. But actually, to live and work among them, I thought they were good eggs. And tremendous.
Of course, what you admired, it seems to me, in those people was their loyalty and that warm-heartedness, that the working-class culture, really.
The solidarity, a very strong feeling of class, a very strong feeling of belonging together, a very strong feeling of not wanting anybody to put them down. But alas, they were not Democrats. They did not believe that they were as good as the next man.
But do you believe that that feeling that you so admired in them is, albeit beneath the surface, because war brings these things to the surface, obviously adversity, but do you believe it still exists today?
I hope so. One of the important things about the working class in those days is the feeling of solidarity around unions, around neighbourhoods, around communities. These have been weakened.
That's what worries you about the 20th century, isn't it? That we are so divided, we are so disparate, that unless we do something, there is only darkness ahead.
Yes, it worries me.
Let's have the next piece of music.
The next piece of music is a song by Billie Holiday. He's funny that way, partly because I cannot conceive of the rest of my life when I cannot listen to Billie Holiday, who was a genius. Not to mention I happen to know, as an old friend, the man who discovered her, and who on his deathbed said, when I asked him what is the thing that he really is proudest in his life of, and he discovered virtually every new jazz artist of the 1930s, says Billie Holiday. The others would have made it without me. Probably she would continue to be a hooker if I hadn't discovered her.
I've got a man crazy for me. He's funny that way.
Billie Holiday and He's Funny That Way. Whatever else you wrote about in the late 40s and 50s when you were teaching, and by this time you were teaching at Birkbeck College in London, weren't you?
Yes.
You never wrote about the Soviet Union. Why not? I mean, your political views were well known, so you couldn't do yourself any more damage, as it were, or delay your promotion. It was already known and delayed.
There was no way in which, in the first place, you didn't know enough about the Soviet Union. In the second place, the official line in the Soviet Union, communist parties, simply was indefensible. So I decided to stick to something which caused less problems, besides.
So you would have had to have promulgated, perpetuated untruths, would you?
I would have had to get into rows with my comrades and friends, unnecessary rows. I wasn't particularly enthusiastic about the Soviet Union by this time, may say so, after having visited it shortly after Stalin's death.
But you didn't, I mean, you still believed in communism as a principle?
Oh, sure. I still believed, obviously, in the movement. But, I mean, I had stopped being a militant for a very long time. From about 1956 on, I carefully recycled myself as a sympathizer rather than as a militant, because by that time I stopped following any official party line.
But a lot of your friends resigned then in the invasion of Hungary. I mean, that was just the last straw, wasn't it? Why didn't you?
I think I didn't wish to deny the whole of my life. We had substantially exactly the same views, my friends and myself, those who left and those who didn't, and we remained friends afterwards. I can't explain why personally I decided. Perhaps also I didn't want to suggest to anybody that I was trying to get an advantage by abandoning views which in the past could not have been said to bring me anything except disadvantage.
But isn't there surely also in all of that an element of also not wishing to say that perhaps you'd been wrong?
No. Not at all. What I said, what I wrote, was as critical as I would have written and said outside the Communist Party.
But here is a party, you say, who were promulgating untruths, who were invading countries, taking actions that you thoroughly and deeply disapproved of, were utterly unjustified.
And protested against.
But why did you still want to belong?
I think one of the great advantages of having been alive as a communist is that nobody can accuse you of having been in it for the sake of careerism or for the sake of making money or for the sake of getting famous or a celebrity. I didn't wish to lose that moral high ground.
More music, number 5.
Offenbach, Minuet from the Orpheus in the Underworld. Firstly, because it reminds me of Paris, and I suppose for about 60 years I've gone to Paris from time to time, stayed there, taught there, enjoyed it, regarded it, as you might say, my second home. Secondly, because Offenbach is consistently unsentimental and knew the difference between a good librettist and a bad librettist, unlike poor Johann Strauss. And third, because he's consistently funny and witty and a good composer.
The Minuet from the final act of Offenbach's Orpheus in the Underworld, with the Paris Philharmonic Orchestra and Chorus conducted by René Leibovitz. How happy do you think you'll be on your desert island, Professor Hobsbawm? Do you like the idea?
Provided I could choose a desert island with a hill or two on it. I don't like absolute flat ones, especially as the sea is going to be completely flat.
And are you a walker?
Yes, a bit.
run up and down the hills a bit. You have family here in London, but you spend 3 months of the year at the moment teaching in New York.
In New York, yes. I've done that for some years.
So does that mean you spend a lot of time alone?
Well, I'm perfectly capable of spending a great deal of time by myself. The whole of the rest of one's life, I'm not so sure about. But otherwise, a month or two on a desert island, for instance, I wouldn't mind too much. Anybody that is an academic and spends a good deal of time reading and writing is used to spending a good deal of one's time alone.
And do you feel these days that you are properly recognised? I mean, you had to fight for it, as we've said, in the early days. You were held back because of your politics. Do you feel these days that the air has cleared and that you receive proper recognition?
How much recognition I've had and all this, I mean, it's not up to me to judge, as it were, what I've done, but I wouldn't wish to complain about it.
Record number six.
Record number six is a bit of nostalgia, I think, suitable for a desert island, and it reminds me of a splendid day in Italy, in Tuscany, with some friends. We were all sitting after lunch looking out over these marvellous hills in the sky, and somebody decided to turn the record player up high. And these were the sounds which went over the sunny valleys of that particular part of Tuscany. And it's Maria Callas singing Casta Diva from Bellini's Norma.
Maria Callas singing the aria Casta Diva from Bellini's Norma, and that was recorded in 1955 at La Scala, Milan. You were rather taken up by Neil Kinnock as a kind of intellectual mascot in the 80s. Did you enjoy that role?
I think Kinnock found it useful to play out somebody with a known track record of being on the extreme left against some of these sectarian left-wingers in the Labour Party who wanted to stop the Labour Party being, in some sense, modernised, or at least brought back to common sense. It wasn't a question of enjoying it. I approved of what he was trying to do, and so, consequently, I'm happy to have been of some use.
Indeed, what you were saying must have been music to his ears, because you were saying, weren't you, that the party had to become a broad church, really, is what you were saying, which was his message.
Yes.
But that must have alarmed a lot of people on the left, people whom you would normally be aligned with.
No, I don't think so. On the whole, the policy of communists, they are sectarian communists and they are common-sense communists. And I hope I was always a common-sense one.
And what does a common-sense communist say today, three if not four defeats later? Is Tony Blair right to warn the left that if they defeat his plans to get rid of Clause 4, then that will be the end of the Labour at the next election?
Reflecting on a desert island is not the moment to start talking about Labour politics. What I think people of my historic background always think is that the best way is to unite all men and women of goodwill as far as possible against the greatest political dangers.
Let's have some more music.
I've heard this very artist with this very trio more than once. A month or two ago in New York, I can listen to this stuff forever. Once again, it's a blues, And it's Kenny Barron, the pianist, with his trio. Here it is.
Kenny Barron Trio and Slow Grind. One of the truths about the 20th century is that all ideologies, not just Marxism, have been discredited. Communism, fascism, Christianity has been marginalised. Democracy is hugely tarnished by sleaze and corruption. What, in your view, can we believe in now? What are your values for the last part of the 20th century?
I still believe in the old values of the 18th century Enlightenment, in reason, in education, in the improvement, if not the perfectibility of human beings, and in the attempts, at any rate, to establish liberty, equality, fraternity, or life, liberty, or the pursuit of happiness, or any of these other marvelous slogans which we owe to the late 18th century.
But you fear what you feared in 1933, which is barbarism. And your message at the end of your book is that we must change, and if we fail to do that, you say, the price is darkness. What do you mean?
I think the price is an increase in the conditions of barbarism which have been gradually creeping up on us, and to which we have become used to an intolerable extent. We now habitually live under circumstances which, at any rate, my parents, certainly my grandparents, would have regarded as intolerable. For instance, what has been happening in Northern Ireland over 25 years, which is now fortunately stopped. These are not ways in which anybody in the 19th century would have regarded it as fit for human beings in the civilized society to live. We live constantly with this sort of thing happening. And I fear that if we don't change, we shall simply get used to living under conditions which ought not to be tolerated by civilized people, but will be tolerated because human beings can get used to almost everything.
Last record?
The last record I find deeply moving, and curiously enough, I discovered this record and the Billie Holiday on the same day in the room of the same student friend in Cambridge in, must have been 1939 or something like this. It's Mahler's Lied von der Erde, which I find profoundly moving, and I hope you're as moved by it as I am.
Thank you.
the end of the final movement of Mahler's Song of the Earth, sung by Kathleen Ferrier with the Vienna Philharmonic, conducted by Bruno Walter. Now, if you could only take one of those eight records, Professor Hobsbawm.
I think I'll take Kenny Barron.
Would you?
Yes, you can listen to it forever, and you don't have to think too much about it.
But you've been so moved by the Schubert and the Mahler, it's...
That's exactly why I take the Kenny Barron. Uh-huh. I don't want to be moved all the time.
And your book?
Probably I'd take a big book by the Chilean poet Pablo Neruda, the best or the one of the famous communist poets of Latin America, called Canto General. I've read some of it, and I read some of it on, I'm told, where you have to do it, on a sort of semi-desert island situation, like on the hills overlooking Machu Picchu. It's written about Machu Picchu. But there's so much in it that I haven't read. Take me a long time to read, and so, anyway, that would be something to get on with.
And your luxury?
Some good binoculars to watch birds with.
That's easy. Professor Eric Hobsbawm, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.